Welcome back to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We are back after our hiatus for Pesach. I'm Lahav Harkov, diplomatic correspondent and senior contributing editor of the Jerusalem Post, and here, as always, with editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz. Yaakov, how's your Pesach?
Pesach was great. I love the holiday. Good one. I'm not so into the matzah so much, but otherwise, it was fun. It was nice. Good to have some time off. How about you?
It was good, but I'm happy to have bread and pizza again. And you are in a really good place for pizza.
I'm in the United States, not in New York at the moment, but the pizza here is pretty good. This is true. Yes.
Yes. Israeli pizza still leaves much to be desired, although it has improved, I think, since I made Aliyah.
Lahav, if I told you what the pizza was like in 1993 when I moved to Israel, and I mean, it's uncomparable to the way it is today, right? The number, the selection, the flavors, the different crusts, the options.
Like, the important thing is that they actually, in most places, they actually use mozzarella cheese. Because the fact that they were using yellow cheese, which is like American cheese, basically, was gross.
Although I will tell you, you know, my first trip to Israel was a kid sometime in the mid-80s, I want to say. I think like 86 or 87, we came here for Pesach. It was my first time in Israel. And I distinctly remember walking down King George Street in Jerusalem and how I was blown away by the fact that there was a kosher for Pesach pizza place that was open in Jerusalem and you could get pizza that was kosher for Passover. It was like coming from Chicago where no restaurant would be open, no kosher restaurant would be open on Pesach. But the fact that not only were they open, we could also get kosher for Passover pizza was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, the Israelis have taken the making Passover versions of food to like another art form. I mean, pizza is like an easy one relatively. But I mean, yeah, you could buy sandwiches. The bread doesn't really taste like real bread.
Because it's not bread. I hate that bread. It's not
yeah,
bread.
I don't like it either. But there are a lot of things. I mean, I had this Pesach, I had burekas, and they were pretty close to the real thing. I don't even know what it was made out of.
Yeah, that's true. But Lahav, let me ask you a question. You
know, the Let's big talk news, about news and not just pizza. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the big news this week seems to be the platform that you spend a lot of time on. I'm not just talking about, obviously, jpost.com is number one, but the second platform is Twitter. And everyone knows you are a great Twitter profile. What do you make of Elon Musk's purchasing of Twitter?
I'm cautiously optimistic. Cautiously because he is taking it private. There will be less transparency. He's like a pretty mercurial guy, you know. So this entire network, which has become a very important platform for journalists, but just for more broadly disseminating information, is now subject to the whims of one person. But I'm optimistic because the changes that he wants to make, I think, are good, which is to say that he wants to have freer speech, and he says he wants to be more transparent about, you know, about the issues of speech. Now, Twitter, people keep talking about Twitter banning former President Trump. I personally don't have a strong opinion about it either way at this point, now that he's not president anymore. When he was president, I thought he should have stayed on the platform, but they waited until really like the last weeks of his presidency. But I think it'll be really interesting to see the impact on the discussion of Israel and on anti-Semitism on the platform, because, you know, anti-Semitism is rampant on Twitter. And on the one hand, it's a horrible thing that needs to be combated. And on the other hand, a heavy hand by a censor can be turned against the people who we like as well. And there have been examples of that, of accounts that exist to fight anti-Semitism, which are then shut down because, I don't know, they had a swastika picture, you know, because they were talking about someone being an anti-Semite. So I think it'll be really interesting. And there's also been a sort of a double standard of, you know, major political figures and leaders can say things like, you know, the Ayatollah Khamenei can call Israel a cancer that needs to be eradicated, basically threatening genocide. And he's allowed because the exact quote from when a Twitter representative spoke out in the Knesset is because it's saber rattling, you know, whereas random people, someone very close to me, for example, was kicked off of Twitter because he quoted former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's position on the Second Amendment, on what it means, what is the right to bear arms. That was the tweet that got him kicked off of Twitter. So, like, weird things happening. So I'm sort of optimistic about the free speech side of things.
I mean, the question that I wonder, though, is I see a lot of, definitely in the U.S., a lot of pundits on the left, particularly, who are really up in arms about this, right? And are afraid about what Elon Musk is going to do to Twitter and how it's going to change politics in America, and it's going to be a censor, like you said. I mean, on the other hand, you did mention the fact, I mean, there's terrible content that comes out on these social media platforms, right? I mean, is it not time for that to be corrected? And not to mention the fact that one of the things that Musk has hinted at is that he does want to put an end to bots, right? That only verified humans can have a Twitter profile.
I think that's a great idea.
I mean, if it's possible to implement, because we just, I mean, I'm sure you get this all the time. You don't know who's real or who's not real.
Yeah, and a lot of times, I mean, it hasn't happened to me in a while, but if I do something or say something very controversial, I could get hundreds of people saying the exact same thing to me, which that I'm sure is bots, basically. It's either bots or there's some kind of message group, like, I don't know, on Reddit or something, telling people to say the same thing to me. But there was an article in The Atlantic recently by Jonathan Haidt, which he's I believe he's a psychology professor, but he's written some interesting books, and he talks about social media and like how it's been so toxic to the political discourse. And actually, this was one of the things that he suggested that could really remedy it, is to make sure that people, not that people have to tweet under their real name, but that at least Twitter, the company, will know that you're a real person. So that I think is also a good move. You know, what I don't like is that he wants there to be an edit button. And while on the one hand, it's annoying when you make a typo, on the other hand, you know, it's just like you can go back and change history, so to speak. Like, if there's an edit button, it should be like Facebook, that when you edit it, there's a record of what you wrote before.
What do you make of this whole, there's also a lot of talk about the algorithm, right? And how he wants to make it an open source algorithm. He doesn't want it to be just that Twitter is deciding what you're going to see, but that people should be able to see what they, you know, whatever's just, I guess, new on the feed. How significant is that?
Well, I don't know if you remember, or I don't know what year you signed up for Twitter, but it used to be just chronological order, right? And now it amplifies things that it thinks will get it more traffic. I'm definitely not an expert on this, but things I've read about social media and the way, you know, how politics have gotten so ugly on social media is that algorithms like that, like what Twitter has and like what Facebook has, is ends up emphasizing and showing more people some of the ugliest tweets or Facebook posts. And so it just makes the politics more and more acrimonious. So if there's a way to opt out of that or a way to fix that, it might be a better thing.
You know, I wonder though, Lahav, this is something I've, especially in Israel, I mean, you know, you're much more active on Twitter than I am. Do you have a sense of, in Israel, is it an echo chamber? Is it really reaching out to the public? Politicians are obviously there, journalists are there, analysts, pundits, people who enjoy politics. But it seems that the Israeli use of Twitter, especially, is very political news focused. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think that it's sort of like an elite social media in Israel. It's people who are involved specifically in those areas and also like big business, high tech. Whereas the most popular platform in Israel is Facebook. I'm not sure what the statistics are in the US, but I do know that in the US, you have all different industries and all different people from different walks of life who like to use Twitter for different reasons. And it's not just about news and politics. So it is very different.
Right. The regular folks in Israel are not, your average person is not on Twitter.
Right.
Which, you know, so it does, I always find it sometimes amusing, these fights that people get into on Twitter, you know, whether it's between two journalists or a politician and another politician. Obviously, it gets amplified by the mainstream media. But it doesn't necessarily, it's not the platform where the people are, right? So politicians do need to somehow, they might get caught up and think, you know, oh, look how many likes I got or look how many retweets I got. But it's not, it might not be real and not, might not translate into political capital.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, also in the U.S., I don't remember the exact quote, but like President Biden, when he was running for president, said something along the lines of like, Twitter is not real life. I think he was quoted like telling his campaign that like they need to not be so focused on Twitter and focus on real life. And, you know, he won. So I guess he was right, even though his chief of staff, Ron Klain, gets like mocked a lot for spending too much time on Twitter. So maybe he needs to remind him of that.
In news, though, that matters to the state of Israel, there's been some developments on Iran, right? And the prospect of a new deal. And we're actually going to talk later in the podcast with Dr. Manuel Navon, who is a French-Israeli expert, definitely on Europe and on France, about the recent election and the re-election of Emmanuel Macron. But I'm curious, Lahav, what is the latest on Iran, which is constantly, we're obviously very focused on it here on this podcast.
Well, I think the latest development is that there have not been any developments. And the fact that there have not been any developments really for about 2 months now is getting to the point where the top Israeli officials' assessment is that there is not going to be an Iran deal. So, you know, the headline here is most likely no Iran deal. And it has come down to this issue of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is on the foreign terrorist organizations list in the U.S. So after the U.S. left the Iran deal, the Trump administration put them on this list. However, the reasons that they're on this list are not necessarily about Iran's nuclear program. They're about sponsorship of terrorism. They are, as Prime Minister Bennett said this week, they are the world's biggest terrorist group. And so the U.S. was not willing to remove them from that list unless Iran was willing to make a reciprocal non-nuclear concession. And one of the things that the U.S. had offered that Iran could do in return was to make a commitment not to attack American officials. And it would have to be a public commitment because Iran basically has like a hit list, especially of former American officials who have been involved in sanctions and sabotage actions against Iran. And, you know, the U.S. doesn't want to have to keep protecting all these people at such a high alert. But Iran have refused. I mean, I don't know other U.S. offers. That's the one that became public. And basically Israel confirmed it again, like more than a month ago. So I don't know what else was offered, but Iran apparently refused everything the U.S. offered. And the Biden administration is not willing to make that concession. It's also politically unpopular. I interviewed Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, when he was about his trip to Israel last month. And he already said then that there's not going to be votes for things like that, like that the political atmosphere will be against it.
But if there is no deal, right, which you're saying seems to be the Israeli assessment right now, we saw Eyal Hulata, the national security advisor to the prime minister, was in Washington this week for high-level talks and, I guess, consultations on Iran and leading a delegation of officials. But if there is no, if there's not going to be a deal, then what is going to happen?
Well, so that's sort of why Hulata was in Washington, to discuss that with his counterpart, Jake Sullivan. It is a very good question. I think that the choice or the options that the U.S. and Israel have are, first of all, to continue sort of sabotage actions to set the nuclear program back, right? I mean, we saw a little bit of a step back from those kinds of actions while the negotiations were taking place. I think that probably if the U.S. decides to put like a real full stop on these talks and say, okay, the negotiations are done, then they'll probably increase sanctions. I mean, why wouldn't they? To put more pressure on Iran. But, you know, it's also a difficult situation with the war going on in Russia, because Russia was sort of, you know, friendly with Iran, but at the same time didn't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. And so they were supposed to be helpful. And now, of course, nobody trusts them. So in some ways, those options are limited as well.
And I mean, I just wonder, does the Biden administration have the bandwidth also to focus on Iran while it's also, we saw the high level visit of Blinken and Austin, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, to Kyiv this week, right, for meetings with Zelensky and his top officials, and they're talking about upping the support, the American support for Ukraine. I mean, can they really deal with both of these major foreign policy issues at the same time?
You know, the Americans like to say that they can walk and chew gum at the same time. But obviously, I mean, there will be some kind of impact, right? Like the Ukraine war is like the biggest thing happening in the world right now. And Iran is just not anybody's top priority except for Israel. And the UAE and Saudi Arabia, I guess.
What did you make, Lahav, of the announcement after the Bennett-Biden phone call this week that Biden plans to come to Israel in the coming months? Why does he want to come to Israel? I had initially thought that maybe this does tie into Iran, that if there's going to be a deal, he would then come and kind of give Israel a big hug, announce some, you know, big support of, I don't know, some sort of military support or whatever it might be to try to ease Israeli concerns. But if there is no deal, what would be the purpose of his visit?
Well, I have to say, like, that phone call, so a lot of people made that their headline, that Biden's going to visit in the next couple of months, but it's not. It isn't new, because the last time they talked on the phone, which was not that long ago, I believe it was like a month ago, Bennett invited Biden and Biden accepted the invitation and there was no specific date for it. And now there's still no specific date for it. So I think it's just generally like U.S. presidents tend to visit Israel a couple times in every term. And, you know, it's been over a year. And so he's willing to come and he wants to show that he supports Israel. It's important to him. Maybe with the midterms coming up, he wants, you know, Democrats to look pro-Israel. But since there's no specific time set yet, it's hard to analyze the purpose of the trip.
So we shouldn't, people don't, you know, get your hopes up yet exactly, or don't worry about his Jerusalem traffic shutting down so quickly.
I literally had a friend who texted me and was like, is he coming when my parents visit Israel? I was like, I don't know. I don't think.
For us Jerusalemites, that's the basic. That's how trips like that really impact. I mean, the city shuts. I remember, you know, back when Bush visited and Obama visited and Trump, of course. I mean, the city comes to a standstill. Some parts of the city, you can't move, right? Because if they're moving from the, you know, between the prime minister's office, the president's house, the prime minister's residence, which that's a whole story in of itself, and the hotel, you can't move in certain parts of the city.
Well, luckily, the Jerusalem Post office is right in front of a light rail station.
And luckily, those still run. You know, it's actually interesting. I wonder if he were to come, where would Bennett host him, Lahav? He doesn't have a home in Jerusalem. Where would they have dinner?
Will Bennett order takeout from the application Wolt? Because that's
he could order it. Wolt is like Uber Eats, and he could just, you know, him and his kids could host him in Ra'anana. There's a lot of security there, right? According to reports, they've spent about 50. The state has spent about 50 million shekel on upgrading the street and the security around his house.
Could I tell you, I spent the last day of Pesach and Shabbat in Ra'anana. My in-laws live a few blocks from Bennett, and Bennett's house is between their house and the synagogue. There's like, it's literally a wall. They built a wall blocking like a whole section in the street. Luckily, Bennett's house is across the street from a vacant lot. And it always has been. I mean, even before he was prime minister, we'd always pass by and be like, oh, that's Bennett's house. But like that whole part of the street is just cut off by walls. It's like, it is crazy. And I understand why the people who live in his neighborhood, not my in-laws, but other people who live in his neighborhood sued, because like it just makes it impossible to get around. Now, people are talking about also the expense of all that security in a place that is not the prime minister's residence. And I know, I mean, you can talk about it, that you think symbolically it's not good either.
To me, it makes no sense, right? In other words, I get the fact that the Balfour residence they claimed originally wasn't ready, although the Bennett family story has changed a number of times. There's different iterations, right? In the beginning, it was that his wife and kids didn't want to leave Ra'anana. Okay, and that's why they were staying. Then it became in recent months that the Shabak wanted to do some security upgrades to the Balfour residence, which is where Netanyahu lived for 12 years. And then until that's ready, he can't move to Jerusalem. But apparently renovations haven't really been done there. But I put all that aside for a moment. And this week, you know, the reason we're talking about this, just as a FYI to our listeners, is because there was a big fight between Bennett and Netanyahu this week about whose family cost the state more, who spent more on gardening and flowers and water bill and electricity, which I got to say, Lahav, I find to be extremely pathetic and childish. It's like two little kids fighting. The big issue here is, you know, first of all, a prime minister, yeah, should have his food taken care of, should have his or her electricity bill taken care of. Like, why are we even talking about this stuff? But and then obviously you mentioned Walt. So his family has been ordering a lot of takeaway to their house in Renana, which again, I don't care.
One of the things that Ben has said, you know, compared to Netanyahu, is Netanyahu lived in the prime minister's residence and therefore had a personal chef. Whereas the Bennett family doesn't have the chef, which...
But again, have a chef. Have three chefs. That doesn't... You're the prime minister. You should have a chef. Like, I mean...
Probably healthier to have a chef, too.
Yeah. The bigger issue is the fact that we have a prime minister who doesn't live in the capital of the state of Israel. I mean, it would be like Joe Biden winning the election saying, hey, I'm still going to take the Amtrak from Delaware because it's... I want to stay there and I don't want to move to the White House. I mean, it's crazy. Right. And to use the security as an excuse, I don't buy it. I'm sorry. If you're the prime minister, you can order the security services to figure things out. And the fact is that Netanyahu was living in that house and he was safe and secure. It doesn't make sense. And I think that symbolism is just sending a bad message. I don't think it's about takeaway. It's about where is the capital of the state of Israel?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And by the way, I also agree that he very aggressive response to this reporting, like when it comes to Netanyahu and the prime minister's office, like released all these graphics. There's like a chart with a picture of Bennett and a picture of Netanyahu comparing all the different expenses. I think it's overkill. But I also think he's very much trying to appeal to the anti-Netanyahu base, because one of the big news stories about Netanyahu has been like his personal expenses, like, how much money did they spend on his home in Caesarea, you know, or like how much money? I remember that there was a whole news cycle about how much money Netanyahu spent on ice cream.
And by the way, Lahav, I think that's what's really behind it all. It's not about security or the kids staying in Renana. It's about not looking like Netanyahu. And that's why they don't want to live at the Balfour residence, because Balfour became this word that is just so synonymous with Netanyahu. That's why him and Lapid are refusing to use the plane called the Wings of Zion right there. There's a plane that Israel spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of shekels on, turning it into an Air Force One, most sophisticated technology, communication systems. Upgraded to, you know, have a bedroom suite, a shower, a boardroom, you name it, and they won't use it, and it just sits on a tarmac. Another ridiculous, you know, decision. And the plane's ready, use the plane, right? But because this government and some of the officials in it are so obsessed with doing everything that's not Netanyahu, they're refusing to use the plane. They're refusing to live in Balfour. They make these comparisons. I mean, like you mentioned, the aggressive response, letting Netanyahu get under their skin in that way. Guys, it's time to move on, right? That's how I see it.
Yeah, I think that, okay, we know that Bennett is not Bibi, and it's not going to work. I mean, the thing is also like, Bennett, I think, has not really been successful in picking up a base from the political center. And he's completely alienated the right with messaging. I mean, this is among the reasons for which he's alienated the right. So it wasn't a politically smart move, and it was very transparent.
So three things to watch four things to watch after today's podcast. Number one, what's Elon Musk going to do with Twitter? Number two, where's Bennett going to host Biden for dinner if Biden comes to Jerusalem? Number three is what's going to be with the takeaway of the Bennett family. Are they still going to order a lot, or are they going to cut down? And number four is what's going to happen with Iran, right? That's obviously the more serious one, I would say.
Yes, definitely Iran is the most serious thing to keep an eye on, but we will be here to discuss any and all of those topics in the future as well. And then another big news story this week was, of course, the presidential election in France. Emmanuel Macron won by a wider margin than had previously been predicted, but still Marine Le Pen, who's on the far right, you know, nationalist candidate, won 40% of the vote. So we have with us Emmanuel Navon, a professor of international relations at Tel Aviv University, to talk to us about that, about the implications for Israel, the Jewish community, the Middle East broadly. So here we go. So on this week's podcast, our guest is Professor Emmanuel Navon of the International Relations Department at Tel Aviv University, and author of The Star and the Scepter, A History of Israel's Foreign Relations, here to talk to us about the results of the election in France this week. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Emmanuel Macron won with roughly 60%, a little bit less, and Marine Le Pen won with a little bit more than 40%. Let's start with what that means for Israel-France relation.
Well, as far as the relation with France is concerned, it's good news, because Macron has been a strong supporter of Israel. He's the first president who said in recent years that anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, but also more practically in terms of the security and defense cooperation between the two countries, he has upgraded that relation. He has increased France's military presence of the French Navy in the East Mediterranean to block Erdogan's attempts to violate the territorial waters of Greece. So he's been taking part of this partnership between Israel, Greece, and Cyprus, also joining the East Med Natural Gas Forum. And also, he has also upgraded France's military presence in the UAE. He has adopted a strong stance on the Iranian negotiations. So on all these issues, I think it's good news for Israel, because he has proved himself being a reliable ally when it comes to Israeli interest and security.
Emmanuel, though, what do you make of the fact that while Macron won the election, Marie Le Pen did have an impressive showing, obviously made it to the second round, received a significant percentage of the vote? And I saw some people, I don't know that much. I'm no expert on French politics, but some people were making a comparison to Mitterrand, and to, there was a runoff many years ago where he got 40% and then eventually became the president of the Republic. So, I mean, does this show a trend in a direction of where France is heading?
Look, I think first of all, we have to realize that Marine Le Pen is definitely, what is generally described today, a populist a nationalist. She congratulated recently Viktor Orban of Hungary for his re-election. Definitely, she belongs to the populist right-wing politics in Europe. But on the other hand, she's different from her father. Her father, who founded this political party, Jean-Marie Le Pen, he is an anti-Semite and a racist. She's not. Not only has she moderated her tone, but she also got rid of a lot of toxic people in the party. So she is different from her father. And also, we need to realize that obviously, even though she got 42% of the vote, there's no way that 42% of the French voters are racist and extremist. They're not. I mean, if you look, for example, at the results she did in the French overseas territories in the Caribbean and the Indian Ocean, she got the majority of the vote, including in Mayotte, in the Indian Ocean, which is a Muslim territory. And most of them voted for Le Pen. Obviously, they're not anti-Muslim or racist. She just got all the vote of people who are against Macron. And also because of her economic platform, she really focused her campaign on the economy, trying to represent people who felt left out by globalization, who felt left out by Macron. Macron is perceived as the president of the rich. That's how he was defined. He's very business friendly. He lowered taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So obviously, it's not that 42% of French voters are radical or racist. It's just that, it was a runoff. And that was the only candidate facing Macron.
But there's still a concern among French Jewry and also French Israelis that the rise of Le Pen could be very, very bad for Jews in France. I mean, you said, she's not a racist, not an anti-Semite, but clearly the Le Pen name means something negative for French Jews. So why, despite her attempts to sort of change the party, is that still a problem?
Well, as far as French Jews are concerned, I would say it has to do with the fact that she she would ban, she in her platform, she said she would ban, you know, the traditional slaughtering, both of the Muslims and the Jews. So that was the concern for the Jews. But obviously, as I said, she's not, you know, and like her father, she's not an anti-Semite. And in fact, as she always says, as she always replies when people ask her about this issue, she said, look, I'm the one really fighting Muslim radicalism, and the Jews are the main target of Islamic radicalism in France. So she has nothing against the Jews per se, just on the issue of slaughtering, she happens to be against, you know, forms of slaughter like Jewish and Muslim slaughtering. There are a few countries in Europe that have already outlawed kosher slaughtering, but that would be, if she had been elected, that would have been probably the only issue regarding the Jews. But as I said, of course, there's the brand Le Pen because of her father, but other than the slaughtering issue, she has absolutely nothing. It wouldn't have been a problem for the Jews.
What do you make, Emmanuel, of the fact that in Israel, a significant percentage, I think, in the first round of the election, we reported also, and there were others, that Eric Zemmour, I'm probably not pronouncing that the right way, but he, the French Jewish journalist and supposed anti-Semite, right, got a lot of the votes in Israel among Israeli French nationals.
Yeah. So first of all, Eric Zemmour is not an anti-Semite. It is absurd to say so. I mean, he himself is Jewish. He openly identifies as a Jew. His wife is Jewish. He attends occasionally an Orthodox synagogue. He observes Jewish holidays. He's not an anti-Semite. He's never accused the Jews of ruling the world of finance, etc., etc. The main reason why Zemmour got such support in Israel is because of his stance regarding Islam and Muslim immigrants. Don't forget that a large percentage of Israelis of French descent or new immigrants from France basically escaped from those suburbs in France where they were victims of violence from their Muslim neighbors. And therefore, they very much identify with what Zemmour had to say about immigration in France and how he demanded from the Muslims, like the rest of the other immigrants in France, to fully assimilate in French culture and French society. Of course, the question is, why would these people, once they live in Israel and are Israelis, first of all, why would they still vote in France? But mostly, why would they still vote as if they were still living in a French suburb being beaten up by their neighbors? They now are in Israel. And yet they still have this attitude of, well, Zemmour is saying what we were thinking when we lived in France, and therefore he has our vote. That's the main reason why he got such a high support in Israel by French Jews.
Well, and I mean, it could be that they're also concerned about friends and family who still live in France. But I'm interested in Zemmour sort of as a broader phenomenon, not just in the Jewish community. I mean, he got so much attention in the last few months, and then it seemed like he really fizzled out in the election. So what do you think happened there?
I think what happened is that it proved that there's a big gap between how popular you can be on TV talk shows and in the social media and the support that you actually get at the ballot box. This is typical of the Zemmour phenomenon. He was very popular, as I said, on social media, on Twitter, in TV talk shows. But then when it comes to voting, you know, at the end of the day, people ask themselves, the fact, for example, that not only Zemmour, but many other candidates did very poorly in the first round, including the center-right candidate Valérie Pécresse, is because people went directly in the first round for the candidate whom they thought had the best chance of making it into the second round, which is why both Macron and Le Pen got so many votes. So once, you know, after the Zemmour hype, after he announced his candidacy and spoke the way he spoke about national identity, about sovereignty, about immigration, again, his popularity was an optical illusion because it was real in the social media and on TV talk shows. But at the end of the day, Marine Le Pen focused really on economic issues, on the cost of living. And people who are anti-elite, anti-EU, figured that, you know, the best chance of getting to the second round was to give the vote to Le Pen and not to Zemmour.
Emmanuel, the Macron in the end of last year paid a very high-profile visit to the Middle East. And it came after the whole, I guess it was called the sub-snub, right? The whole issue that happened with the submarines that were supposed to be sold to Australia. And then Australia backed away in coordination with the United States. And that was seen as a big slap in the face of the French. But Macron came to Saudi Arabia, the UAE. He visited Beirut, I think, at least twice last year. Is there a shift that you noticed in the way he's been perceiving the Middle East and in his approach to the Middle East? Or should we expect something now new, now that he's been reelected for a new term and his position is now safe? Or should we just expect the same kind of French old traditional approach?
So, first of all, there is a shift in that, not only under Macron, but also earlier, before his own presidencies, there's been already a shift of French military focus from sub-Saharan Africa to the Middle East and to the Gulf. Under Macron, a lot of French forces have been pushed aside by the Russian-backed Wagner Group in French-speaking Africa. And even though the French still have a military presence there, they are definitely putting more emphasis on their military presence in the Gulf. I mentioned before that they have a military base in the United Arab Emirates. Macron also, as I said, has a tough stance on the question of the negotiations with Iran. So, I would definitely expect him to put more focus on joining a Western coalition against Iran. You mentioned before the incidents with the United States regarding the submarines. I think they made up their differences, and that today Macron is definitely on board to join a Western alliance against Russia in the case of Ukraine, but also vis-a-vis China. This, of course, would not have been the case if Le Pen had won, because Le Pen had very strong pro-Putin credentials. So after Macron and Biden made up after the incident regarding the submarines, Macron, I think, is definitely going to join this Western alliance against Iran. He's not going to oppose the United States as Le Pen would have done. By the way, Le Pen, part of her platform was to quit NATO's military command, which is obviously not something that Macron is going to do. And last point is that something I heard actually a few months ago from a senior French diplomat, who said that if Macron gets reelected, he would very significantly redraw France's foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel and the Middle East by upgrading France's relation with Israel and challenging even the French tradition of or the French policy of what is called France's Arab policy. So we might expect definitely under Macron not only a realignment with the United States, but also an upgrading of the military relationship with Israel in order to face Iran.
That is very interesting. I mean, it's almost like a post-Abraham Accords thing, right? Like when the Abraham Accords happened, France was one of the countries that like didn't know how to react. They almost didn't seem happy about it. Now it seems like they're almost thinking of following in their footsteps. I want to go back to something you had briefly mentioned, which is Le Pen's support for Putin. Macron himself was really maybe the only European leader who was trying to negotiate and trying to really talk to Putin in the run-up to the war of Ukraine. And I think certainly in the English language media, it was seen as like a little bit of an embarrassment how it didn't go anywhere and really Putin just lied to Macron. Did that play out at all in the election, the difference in their approaches to Putin and to the war in Ukraine?
I mean, definitely the fact that Le Pen is one of those, populist European leaders who got the support of Putin. I mean, she basically removed a picture of her with Putin from her platform. I mean, it was already printed. And there was a picture of her with Putin, and of course she removed it after Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. in their debate a week ago, Macron said to Marine Le Pen, you know, when you speak to Putin, you speak to your banker, which is true because she got a loan from a Russian state bank. And again, Putin has been supporting politically and also financially all those populist parties in Europe that are opposed to the EU, such as Orban in Hungary, because of course Putin for many years has been trying to undermine the EU and NATO. So the fact that Le Pen, despite her denial, was so identified with Putin, did not condemn the annexation of Crimea in 2014, this also very much affected her credibility vis-a-vis many voters. Even though, again, many of the people who voted for her didn't really care about this. They care more about the cost of living. But Macron came out as a statesman with 5 years of experience as head of state, who did try, I mean, who first of all did adopt a very strong stance against Russia after the invasion of Ukraine, who tried to prevent the war. And I think most voters appreciate the fact that he tried to prevent the war, even though he was not able to do so. And I think that Macron himself totally realizes today that his attempts at the beginning of his presidency 5 years ago to try and bring Putin around and to try to build a new partnership between Russia and Europe in order to face China together, I think he realizes today that it was a mistake. It was an illusion. Putin, of course, never had such an intention. And therefore, I think Macron realizes today that this whole theory of many think tanks in Paris, that you had to embrace Russia in order to face China together, it was completely mistaken. And I think today he's fully aware of that.
You mentioned a possible coalition with Iran. And I'm curious, you know, over the years, even if I go back to 2015 to the JCPOA, there was a feeling at the time that the French might have been more aggressive on Iran than even the Americans were. But sometimes you hear Israelis who kind of quietly hope that maybe the French would do something to help stop a bad deal from going forward. Is there any credence to that? Does France really view this differently, let's say, than the Biden administration or the United States?
Well, first of all, before the negotiation, before the JCPOA, during the negotiations, even though it was under a different French government, but France at the time did adopt a pretty tough stance on those negotiations with Iran. And even today, as we're talking, as you know, there's no new deal. No new deal has been signed. You know, there's been talk for many weeks, if not months, that you know a deal is imminent. No such deal has been signed, and it might be that it never will be. I think that not only the French, but also the Biden administration today has toughened its stance on the negotiations with Iran. Probably has to do, of course, with the war in Ukraine and the way, of course, Russia can no longer be counted on as a reliable partner to negotiate a new deal with Iran as far as the U.S. is concerned. So I think that the fact that a no new deal has been signed with Iran despite those lengthy negotiations has to do not only about Macron's and France's stance on this issue, but also I think the Biden administration itself is getting cold feet on the deal with Iran.
So if we're talking about France, one issue I think that we didn't delve into is anti-Semitism in France. I mean, we touched on it a little bit, but you know, there are increasing, maybe not increasing, but there are many cases of violence against Jews going on. And often the enforcement and the sort of the verdicts and court cases against the perpetrators have been very weak. Now, Macron has criticized those verdicts, but the question is, has he actually done anything? Have there been any changes in policy that French Jews can point to that have been helpful?
Well, first of all, of course, the judiciary is independent, of course, from the government in France. And when it comes to, you know, applying sentences to offenders, it's done by courts and not by the government. And that's something that Macron generally reminds people that, you know, there is a judicial system and the judges are the one deciding about the sentences regarding anti-Semitic attacks. After the case of Sarah Halimi, Macron himself said that the law had to be changed because, as you remember, the criminal who murdered Sarah Halimi was not sentenced because he was high on pot, and so there was a loophole in the law that his lawyers used. And Macron said the law has to be changed, and that, as far as I understand, they've been working on it. I think Macron, unlike some of his predecessors, I mean, definitely during the first wave of Muslim-dominated anti-Jewish violence in the early 2000s, during the Second Intifada, at the time, definitely under Chirac, for example, the French government tried to look the other way and pretend that this violence didn't really exist. I think today the French authorities are no longer in denial about the fact that majority of anti-Semitic attacks in France today are perpetrated by Muslims. And I think Macron does not deny that. And as I said, I mentioned before that he also declared a couple of years ago that the demonization of Israel is a form of anti-Semitism, that anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. And so I think this is also a difference between him and previous French presidents.
Well, Emmanuel, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your insight about the recent French elections. And we'll wait to see what happens with this new administration of Emmanuel Macron and his New Year's.
There are elections coming up for Parliament. Don't forget that he's not out of the woods yet, because even though he has been re-elected with a large margin, his ability to govern will depend on the outcome of parliamentary elections next month, because in the French constitution, a president with a majority is very powerful, but a president without a majority in parliament is powerless.
Right. Maybe, he could come to Jerusalem and get some lessons from Naftali Bennett in how to keep a government together without a majority.
In France, once you're elected president, you're there for 5 years, but he might have to appoint a prime minister not of his liking if a majority in the National Assembly emerges against him. And in that case, he would be president for 5 years, regardless of the political situation, but he might not be able to implement his policy.
Right.
Do you think that's likely?
He's definitely not going to have this large majority in parliament, which he obtained 5 years ago, because 5 years ago, people were still very enthusiastic about him, so they gave him a strong majority. Today, it all depends how the opposition and the right gets organized, how many people from the right join him or run against him. But again, his party is not going to have the same result as it did 5 years ago. So he might have to build some kind of coalition against his own will. We don't know. I mean, they haven't seen any polls yet, but it's not going to be as easy for him as it was 5 years ago regarding the majority in parliament.
All right. Very interesting. Thank you so much, Professor Emmanuel Novelli.
Thank you, Emmanuel.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us this week. Great to be back with Lahav for the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be back next week, and you can find us, as always, on all of the major podcast player platforms. Take care.